That night, Gulberg's life underwent a radical change. The notion of secrecy took on a whole new dimension. He saw immediately the need to create a new structure around the defector. He decided to include Björk in the Zalichenko unit. It was a reasonable decision, since Björk already knew of Zalichenko's existence. Better to have him on the inside than a security risk on the outside. Björk was moved from his post within the immigration division to a desk in the apartment in Östermalm. In the drama that followed, Gulberg chose from the beginning to inform only one person in SIS, namely the head of secretariat, who already had an overview of the activities of the section. The head of secretariat sat on the news for several days before he explained to Gulberg that the defection was so big that the chief of SIS would have to be informed, as well as the government. By that time, the new chief of SIS knew about the section for special analysis, but he had only a vague idea of what the section actually did. He had come on board recently to clean up the shambles of what was known as the Internal Bureau affair, and was already on his way to a higher position within the police hierarchy. The chief of SIS had been told in a private conversation with the head of secretariat that the section was a secret unit appointed by the government. Its mandate put it outside regular operations, and no questions should be asked. Since this particular chief was a man who never asked questions that might yield unpleasant answers, he acquiesced. He accepted that there was something known only as SSA, and that he should have nothing more to do with the matter. Gulberg was willing to accept this situation. He issued instructions that required even the chief of SIS not to discuss the topic in his office without taking special precautions. It was agreed that Zalichenko would be handled by the Section for Special Analysis. The outgoing Prime Minister was certainly not to be informed. Because of the merry-go-round associated with a change of government, the incoming Prime Minister was fully occupied appointing ministers and negotiating with other Conservative parties. It was not until a month after the government was formed that the chief of SIS, along with Gulberg, drove to Rosenbad to inform the incoming Prime Minister. Gulberg had objected to telling the government at all, but the chief of SIS had stood his ground. It was constitutionally indefensible not to inform the Prime Minister. Gulberg used all his eloquence to convince the Prime Minister not to allow information about Zalichenko to pass beyond his own office. There was, he insisted, no need for the Foreign Minister, the Minister of Defence, or any other member of the government to be informed. It had upset Feldin that an important Soviet agent had sought asylum in Sweden. The Prime Minister had begun to talk about how, for the sake of fairness, he would be obliged to take up the matter at least with the leaders of the other two parties in the coalition government. Gulberg was expecting this objection, and played the strongest card he had available. He explained in a low voice that if that happened, he would be forced to tender his resignation immediately. This was a threat that made an impression on Feldin. It was intended to convey that the Prime Minister would bear the responsibility if the story ever got out, and the Russians sent a death squad to liquidate Zalichenko. And if the person responsible for Zalichenko's safety had seen fit to resign, such a revelation would be a political disaster for the Prime Minister. Feldin, still relatively unsure in his role, had acquiesced. He approved a directive that was immediately entered into the secret protocol, making the section responsible for Zalichenko's safety and debriefing. It also laid down that information about Zalichenko would not leave the Prime Minister's office. By signing this directive, Feldin had in practice demonstrated that he had been informed, but it also prevented him from ever discussing the matter. In short, he could forget about Zalichenko. But Feldin had required that one person in his office, a hand-picked state secretary, also be informed. He would function as a contact person in matters relating to the defector. Gulberg allowed himself to agree to this. He did not anticipate having any problem handling a state secretary. The chief of SIS was pleased. The Zalichenko matter was now constitutionally secured, which in this case meant that the chief had covered his back. Gulberg was pleased as well. He had managed to create a quarantine, which meant that he would be able to control the flow of information. He alone controlled Zalichenko. When he got back to Östermalm, he sat at his desk and wrote down a list of the people who knew about Zalichenko. Himself, Björk, the operations chief of the section, Hans von Röttinger, assistant chief Frederick Clinton, the section's secretary, Eleanor Badenbrink, and two officers whose job it was to compile and analyze any intelligence information that Zalichenko might contribute. 7 individuals who over the coming years would constitute a special section within the section. He thought of them as the inner circle. Outside the section, the information was known by the chief of SIS, the assistant chief, and the head of secretariat. Besides them, the prime minister and a state secretary. A total of 12. Never before had a secret of this magnitude been known to such a very small group. Then Gulberg's expression darkened. The secret was known also to a 13th person. Bjork had been accompanied at Zalichenko's original reception by a lawyer, Niels Erik Bjurman. To include Bjurman in the special section would be out of the question. Bjurman was not a real security policeman. He was really no more than a trainee at SIS, and he did not have the requisite experience or skills. Gulberg considered various alternatives and then chose to steer Bjurman carefully out of the picture. He used the threat of imprisonment for life, for treason, if Bjurman were to breathe so much as one syllable about Zalichenko, and at the same time he offered inducements, promises of future assignments, and finally he used flattery to bolster Bjurman's feeling of importance. He arranged for Bjurman to be hired by a well-regarded law firm, which then provided him with a steady stream of assignments to keep him busy. The only problem was that Bjurman was such a mediocre lawyer that he was hardly capable of exploiting his opportunities. He left the firm after 10 years and opened his own practice, which eventually became a law office at Odenplan. Over the following years, Gulberg kept Bjurman under discreet but regular surveillance. That was Bjurk's job. It was not until the end of the 80s that he stopped monitoring Bjurman, at which time the Soviet Union was heading for collapse and Zalichenko had ceased to be a priority. For the section, Zalichenko had at first been thought of as a potential breakthrough in the Palmer mystery. Palmer had accordingly been one of the first subjects that Gulberg discussed with him during the long debriefing. The hopes for a breakthrough, however, were soon dashed, since Zalichenko had never operated in Sweden and had little knowledge of the country. On the other hand, Zalichenko had heard the rumour of a red jumper, a highly placed Swede or possibly other Scandinavian politician who worked for the KGB. Gulberg drew up a list of names that were connected to Palmer: Carl Lidbom, Pierre Skori, Sten Andersson, Marita Ulfskog, and a number of others. For the rest of his life, Gulberg would come back again and again to that list, but he never found an answer. Gulberg was suddenly a big player. He was welcomed with respect in the exclusive club of selected warriors, all known to one another, where the contacts were made through personal friendship and trust, not through official channels and bureaucratic regulations. He met James Jesus Angleton, and he got to drink whiskey at a discreet club in London with the chief of MI6. He was one of the elite.